Star Wars. We've come to the right place because the right place is back on the JCU. The Rancor Pit, the original Rancor Pit classic, is finally...
Except no substitutes.
That's right. Just the voices, not the faces. This is the original Rancor Pit, and we're back here. We got our momentum now. We're not going to give you like 6 month gaps anymore between episodes. So this is episode 70 of the Rancor Pit. And of course, joining me as always is the Star Wars scholar himself.
Right. I'm Eddie Medina, and we are also joined by a very, very special guest, a longtime listener, but never... Well, he popped up once on one of our special episodes, but we have none other than Eric Shirey. Eric, say hello.
Hey, how's everybody doing out there?
Excellent.
Yeah, if you're like a Rancor Pit completist, you probably remember Eric when he popped in for Cole at when we did our live broadcast at the Air Hogs baseball game. Eric and Colleen joined us out there to track down a Chewbacca mom, and it didn't really end well. But
yeah,
that's another story.
I'm glad I missed that crushing disappointment, but much like Chewbacca mom's career, what? laugh it up. Okay.
Yeah, right.
So with. The reason we wanted Eric, and I'm so glad we actually delayed a few days just to make sure that we could get Eric as a guest, because it was imperative for this episode, which is, as I said, number 70, when Lucas got hammered. And
that's Eric, very fitting.
Isn't it? Eric Shirey is a... Hammer horror film aficionado of the First Order.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know about that, but okay.
You're the first.
Right. I'm talking about from the First Order in episode 7 and 8.
Yeah.
You literally started a militant organization to force people to watch all over the galaxy to watch Hammer films.
Right.
You're like the Kylo Ren of British horror. Yes.
You really are. I remember, and I'm sure, Eric, you remember this too. Eric put on this Hammer horror birthday party at back when the shop was still called Lone Star Comics and it was still located on Abrams in Arlington. Eric did like an actual Hammer horror birthday party, and he had myself out as an artist, Jason McLean of Vagabond Nerds, and James O'Barr was there, correct?
James O'Barr was there, if I recall.
And,
yes.
And the voice of What's that character from G-Force, the main villain?
Oh, Zoltar?
Yeah. It was the same guy who played the hitchhiker in the original Chainsaw Massacre. He was, wasn't he there?
Oh, Ed Neil.
Yeah,
Ed Neil.
Yeah, he was there.
That was the amazing thing. That was back when, like, Eric could just conjure local celebrities up at will.
I know.
It would be like, how did you do that? I don't know. I just came and asked him. I'm like, no, that doesn't work. It's not how that happens, but apparently it did.
That was a fun, that was a fun event. And that was my, I had heard of these movies, but I have never heard them referred to as the Hammer horror films until Eric put this event on. And that kind of was like my intro into that world of the Hammer films.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been into it. Peter Cushing is my guy. Mm-hmm. That's my main guy. I actually have a Grand Moff Tarkin museum. Like a mini museum. Uh-huh. It's the only character that I collect. So
yeah, especially since he hasn't got that much coverage. Especially it took till like the 90s to get any kind of traction on collectibles.
Right.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, go ahead, Eric.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just, it was pretty easy to collect him until recently when, Rogue One came along, and now it seems like he's a little bit more in the public eye. And the book, the Tarkin book, which is a great book. And it's canon. It's still canon.
it's sort of PD canon, which is the post Disney period.
Yep, that's right.
For those of you who got really distraught, but I think for the unfamiliar, Eric, before we get really into both Peter Cushing and yet another actor who was a staple of this studio, could you give the listeners a little insight into what we're talking about? If they're like Eddie and like, I've not heard this term, this umbrella of Hammer horror.
Right. Basically in the 50s, it started, well, I mean, it started before that, but in the 50s, there was a studio. It was out of, I don't want to say London. It was on the outskirts of London.
We'll say London adjacent.
It was bright.
It was across the pond, as it were.
Yes.
Well, there was actual pond. It wasn't like, you know, the ocean. It was just a little pond.
Right. And it was Bray. It's Bray, England, which is out like us. Yeah, right. It's outside of London. And they had a studio, Bray Studios.
Uh-huh.
And basically, these guys would just – they just started putting out a horror. The first one they put out was Curse of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
They got permission to do it from Universal, but Universal wouldn't let them. Well, I guess they didn't get permission from them because it was Frankenstein. It was public domain.
Yes.
Yeah.
But basically, they were more. It was. They were Technicolor, so it was the opposite of Universal. Universal was black and white, very shadowy. Most of them were modern. They were modernized for the time. They were modernized. Like Frankenstein took place in the 30s.
Yeah.
And what Hammer did was Hammer stuck to the guns. They did Victorian era classic period pieces. And there would always be eyeballs falling on the ground and then they're squishing in them, or there would be bottles like jars with hearts in them. They were trying to push the envelope for the time.
Well, and you have to understand, to give that some context, like the squishing of the eyeballs and the hearts and jars, England had very stringent film censors.
Yeah.
To the point, yeah, I remember reading about Ray Harryhausen doing the Cyclops and the Sinbad movies. Now he had to be careful not to paint too much blood on the creature's victims.
Well,
because they were really worried about the British censors.
Yeah.
Most
of the Hammer films in the 50s and the 60s were certified X.
Are you serious?
Yeah, in England.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I had heard that England. Little tidbit.
But they were very, for the time, they were pretty racy. There was a lot of bosoms, I guess you would say.
It was like John Carpenter meets Benny Hill.
Yeah, there was a lot of corsets.
Benny Hill.
Benny Hill. But two of the actors, it was kind of like a family. The studio was like a family unit. There were certain directors that always worked on the films, and there were certain actors and actresses that were always in the films. And most of the time, if you would talk to Christopher Lee, he got tired of doing them because he felt like he was getting typecast, which he was.
Yeah.
But they would basically come to him and blackmail him into being in the movies because he was like, the producer guy would be like, hey, man, if you don't do the film, these other actors aren't going to have any jobs and they're not going to be able to do anything. So they would.
Wow.
Oh, OK. So it was more like.
And you've actually invoked the other name that we're going to be talking about tonight. If you happen not to look at the banner, we're going to be talking about Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, because both of them steeped in Hammer horror, and yet both wound up having a Star Wars pedigree decades apart.
And another reason why we are dropping this episode now is their birth dates just came up. Peter Cushing having his birthday on May 26, 1913, and Christopher Lee just a day later, May 27th, 1922. And so we were trying to kind of aim for that time frame, as it were. So it kind of worked out perfectly on different levels, on the birthday aspect, the Star Wars aspect, and the Hammer Horror aspect.
Right. Now, what the thing though is that they had a family unit. It was kind of a family unit type thing.
Yeah.
But Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing were in the first real Hammer Horror film, which was Curse of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
That's what it was called over here. Over there, it was just called Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Lee would always play the monster, and Cushing would always play the doctor or the scientist guy. He would play the quote unquote good guy, or the, like, Frankenstein. He would play Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And,
yes, exactly.
Basically, they would always play against each other, and this went on for decades. I mean,
well, you know, and very often Christopher Lee was kind of a well-known vampire.
Well, yeah,
in the horror films, and I think that if I'm not mistaken, Peter Cushing was often the kind of Van Helsing to whatever vampire Lee was.
Yeah, he was the Van Helsing, and then when they decided to bring Dracula into modern times, he was, of course, Van Helsing's great grandson or something.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, I mean, Cushing, and the funny thing is, just, I mean, I know we're kind of all over the place, but the funny thing is that you have this big behemoth guy, Christopher Lee, 6'3" or whatever he was, and then you'd have, you know, Cushing, who was, I guess he was about 6 feet, maybe 5'9", I don't know. But he was shorter than Lee, obviously.
Yeah, right.
But these guys are in these horror movies, and both of them are like total gentlemen.
Oh, and, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and Cushing was like he quit acting because his wife died. He quit acting to take care of his wife, and then when she did finally die, he ended up coming back and doing stuff again, but he was never the same after that. But yeah, these guys, I mean, they just, they mistakenly became classic horror staples.
Funny you mentioned the gentlemanly aspect, because one of my favorite stories, you can find it in J.W. Rensler's The Making of Star Wars.
Right.
And there's a quote that was derived from some interview or something with Peter Cushing from back in the 70s. And he was talking about how anytime, you know, he would have a major role, he would always, you know, tidy. He was just such a tidy man. He said he would just douse himself with rose water and use an entire, you just practically have to do it in his voice, use an entire tube of Colgate dental cream. And then it was followed by this wonderful line where he says, "Every time I see a love scene in a movie, I can't help but wonder, I hope they remember to brush their teeth."
Okay.
Well, his big thing was lavender.
Oh, no, that's right. I said rose water. It was lavender water. Yes, he was.
Yes. Yeah, when I went to London, I went to the Sherlock Holmes Museum because he actually played Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yes,
I remember that.
Yeah, he played, and strangely enough, he played Sherlock. Christopher Lee played the Hound, he played Henry Baskerville.
Oh, wow. Was this in the same made-for-TV movie?
No, it wasn't a made-for-TV movie, man. It was Hound of the Baskervilles for Hammer.
Oh, okay, because he played Sherlock Holmes in a made-for-TV movie after he did Star Wars, because I remember he played Sherlock Holmes, because I remember seeing it thinking, that's Grand Moff Tarkin.
He was in the show for the BBC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was actually Sherlock Holmes in a, like, television show.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah, see, I was only familiar because I remember when the made-for-TV movie came on and he was in it. I remember thinking, oh, that's Grand Moff Tarkin. That's pretty cool.
Right. Yeah. But, yeah, when I went to, because I went to London, and honestly, I looked very heavily into going to Whitstable, which is where, or Whitstable, like I can't remember which one it is, but that's where he lived until he died.
Oh, okay.
And it was too far away. I couldn't get there through a bus or through the thing, but I really seriously was going to go there. Because they have like a bench and they have like a pub and you can go to his house. I actually went on Google Maps and did a tour of his house on the inside and the outside.
Okay, stalker much?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, the reason is because the house was for sale.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, his house was for sale.
So you could actually just go to the real estate website and creep up.
Yes.
It doesn't really count as creeping if the man has passed away now from like 20 years after the fact. Well, he's like creeping on
that. Well, and the crazy thing is man, that they were like there was like a, I mean, I know this is going way far over the edge, but there was like a garden bed brick wall that he had made and it was still there.
Yeah.
The same garden, like brick wall. And like these, like, I don't know, cupboards or something that he built for his stamp collection and stuff.
Wow.
Still there. And I was like, oh my gosh.
How incredibly British.
I know, right?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, granted, he was British, but some British are just incredibly British.
He was way into stamp collecting, man. There's like pictures of him, like, in his thing. And yeah. But either way, okay, so. what else?
Where he's looking at the stamps with the magnifying glass from Top Secret.
Really? obviously, I thought I knew Peter Cushing's, you know, filmography well, but I had no idea, just glancing at it right here, he played Doctor Who a few times.
Oh, yeah. He was
in
Doctor
Who. Yeah, that's true. I think it's actually like stage stuff is Doctor Who.
Well, he did two movies.
Yeah, they're showing two movies here.
Oh, that's right, yes. Okay.
Hey. The two movies?
Yeah.
We're for the competitor studio.
Oh, okay. So is that why he's not considered one of the main Doctor Who's?
No. What I mean by the competitor, there was two major horror houses in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
In the England area, and it was Amicus, and it was Hammer.
Uh-huh.
And him and Lee would hop back and forth between Amicus and Hammer. When Hammer wasn't doing something, they'd take a job with Amicus.
Yeah.
So they would do like, what is it? The House That Dripped Blood. What was the Scream one? Scream and Scream Again.
Yeah. So it's kind of like John Byrne would do in Marvel and DC, just jump back and forth between Marvel and
DC.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. And the funny thing is that they would be in the movies together on the Amicus ones too.
Yeah.
He'd be like in the skull, you know,
if you look at both of their body of work, they're practically joined at the hip for most of their career.
Uh-huh. Well, they were best friends.
So they're,
well, it's amazing that they weren't both in Star Wars at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are pictures of the two of them that Lee posted before he died, because Cushing died before Lee did, because Lee just passed away a few years back.
Yeah,
but Lee had pictures of him and Cushing the last time they saw each other.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Which, and they're online. You can find them.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were best friends until Cushing died.
So they were kind of like back in their day. They were the Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen of their day, I guess.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, yeah. Because I don't really know if they hang out. Do those two hang out together?
It appears to be.
Do they ever?
Yeah, they go bar hopping and everything together. Apparently, riding and.
Oh yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All sorts of stuff.
Yeah. No, I didn't know that. Well, yeah, I didn't know that.
Going back to
I do want to go back to the Doctor Who thing.
Yeah, that's all I was going to ask too. But go ahead.
I would like to make it very clear to everyone out there, he's the only Doctor Who that I pay attention to.
So
whoa, wow!
That was my question.
Tom Baker can suck it, and that other guy, and the other guy, and the other guy.
Well, what I was going to ask is, what number Doctor Who is
Jonathan
he?
Pertwee?
Because they always say that he's the fifth doctor, he's the sixth doctor, seventh.
No. He was not an official doctor.
That's what I'm saying. Whenever I've seen like the action figures or like the people posting stuff of all the Doctor Who's together, I've never seen him in there, and that's why I was surprised just now when I saw his name as Doctor Who.
There were some other doctors that weren't part of the official BBC. It's kind of like Sean Connery and Never Say Never Again. Oh,
that the one lone.
Actually, it's. Yeah, it's exactly like that. It's exactly like that.
The Bond film that wasn't part of all the other Bond films. Yes.
Exactly. Right. The one that's at the kids' table.
Yeah, he did two of them, and he did Doctor Who and the Daleks, or Daleks, however you say it. I really am not into Doctor Who, which might get me kicked off the show, but I'm sorry.
Thankfully, this isn't like, the TARDIS... I can't even come up with an analog off the top of my head on this one.
No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah,
he plays a lot of doctors. I'm just this one little section of his filmography. He was Dr. Brecht, Dr. Namoroff, Dr. Terror, Dr. Who, Dr. Stanley, and Dr. Stone. It's like he plays a lot of doctors, and that's just this one little snippet.
Dr. Howard, Dr. Fine, Dr. Howard.
But you know, and the other thing is there was a whole group of actors back then that were always old.
He was one of those people who his entire career he was a geezer, kind of like Burgess Meredith,
right, or Wilford Brimley or somebody.
The other day we were watching Forever Old. I'll give you the perfect example. The other day I'm sitting here for lunch and we're watching Andy Griffith.
Yeah,
and they show a picture of Barney Fife when he was in high school.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that dude was 60 his whole life.
I had to go into acting because I looked like I was pushing 40 when I was 12.
Yeah.
That's not a bad rendition.
I mean, in all honesty,
that's one of my favorites.
When you look at Cushing in 1957's Curse of Frankenstein, he looks like he's already 50.
Right. Because you're right. He was in the Abominable Snowman movie, of course, being a big cryptid fan. And I do remember him being in that. That came out, looking at it now, it looks like it came out the same year as Curse of Frankenstein. And I remember thinking, this dude has always been old, because I remember him distinctly from that movie.
And I think one of the reasons why and this is a personal thing, and maybe it is why I'm so attached to him as an actor, but my grandfather, for some reason, I would see Peter Cushing and I would think of my grandfather, because my grandfather kind of had features like him.
Yeah.
So I don't know, man. I don't know what it is, but for some reason, I've always just been somehow emotionally tied to Peter Cushing.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. Let's talk a bit about kind of bring Cushing first into the Star Wars fold.
Okay.
Because when Star Wars came out, I'm pretty sure I must have seen some Hammer horror stuff on TV, on the UHF stations, because it was probably cheap to obtain. They were thrilled to export it.
Yep.
And it's just good, fun horror, especially when you're a kid. And so I was familiar enough. I'd seen this guy places before. And you look at the nature of the character of Tarkin, and I just can't imagine anyone else being cast. I mean, granted, we were burdened with the fact that he was cast. But if you look at just his work, and it was just sort of the ideal, because he could play a good guy or he could play a bad guy.
Right.
And there was this level of sophistication and screen presence that he brought.
Mm-hmm. Right. Totally. Yeah, completely. And I mean, it's not really a surprise, because I mean, when you look at who... there's something else we need to go into with this, but with the Star Wars connection. But it makes all the sense in the world if you look at what Lucas was into as a kid.
You read my mind, because I'm thinking, you know, as a film buff, he had to be thinking, oh, here's the guy. You know, I don't know how directly he was involved in the choice there, but it just seems like the role's purpose.
Yeah. I can tell you right now that that was all about Lucas. Lucas picked him. I mean, handpicked him.
Yeah, you have to imagine to be like, okay, my first choice is Peter Cushing. My second choice is Peter Cushing.
Right, exactly. And what's funny is that, not to get off on a tangent about this, but Darth Vader was also in the Hammer
films.
Yes,
that's right. That's right.
Prowse played the monster from hell. Opposite of Cushing. So basically, Darth Vader and Peter Cushing, or I mean Dave Prowse and Peter Cushing.
they already had a connection.
Yeah.
Of Cushing.
Well, didn't Peter Mayhew also have a horror connection, a Hammer connection? Or am I wrong with that?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. Because you got to remember, before he got the role of Chewbacca, he was a nurse.
Oh, yeah, I know, but...
Yeah, he was actually an orderly in London Hospital.
Yeah, I guess I should say nurse.
Oh, same. But he was working in the hospital, and his only other screen credit prior to Star Wars was as the live-action stand-in for the Minotaur.
That's what I'm thinking of.
The Minotaur. Sinbad.
Okay, Sinbad.
For close-ups and stuff. Yeah. And he would have giant, heavy, gilded rubber suit.
Right. Okay, that's where I was getting confused. I remember he was in something that would always come on, like Channel 27 back in the day. And Sinbad.
At Channel 27, damn it.
But yeah, I mean, it was definitely the fact that Prowse and Cushing playing opposite each other in Star Wars is proof that Lucas knew what he was doing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he knew what he was doing, and he knew the dynamics there. And,
one of the things that comes up often is, why is the entire empire British? Mm-hmm. And it's the thing about it is, it's economically sound wherever you're filming. Your best bet is to cast all of your minor roles locally.
Of course, yeah.
Right.
And since everything was done at Pinewood, you know, it's just a no-brainer that they would just be bringing in. There'd be tons of British actors swarming anything.
Well, and the other thing is that those guys were working-class actors. I mean, they weren't making Tom Cruise money. They were working... I mean, and I don't want it to sound bad, but they were working job to job to job.
Oh, absolutely, because Hammer wasn't a big, you know, they weren't making the billions of pounds of film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the same could be said of anything of that era. I mean, look at the Star Trek crew. Yeah, people would just assume because they were famous beyond famous. But, I mean, they weren't getting paid much per episode back in the day either.
No, in fact, you know, after... the series, Shatter was living out of his truck.
Exactly.
For
out of a camper and stuff. Yep. Yeah.
But to the point about the, you know, them being working class actors, especially, to kind of put it in a 70s context, they weren't making Burt Reynolds money.
No.
Gary Coleman money.
Oh, wow. Now, those guys were working job to job, and what's funny is that they were more talented than half the people that were making millions.
Oh, well, that's always the case, though. I mean, you got to be honest, that's the case nowadays. I mean, those who we should be throwing money at because of their unique talent aren't getting the recognition. And then you got Justin Bieber, you know.
Don't ever mention that name on my show again.
But yeah, the I mean, I don't really know what direction we're going in here, but Cushing,
in every direction.
I mean, Cushing was, I mean, kind of fast forwarding everything.
Yeah.
when they announced that he was going to be in Rogue One.
Yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts on that, because I didn't know that was going to be a thing until I saw the movie.
I didn't either. I had not heard anything in advance about that.
And so that really caught me off guard.
There was definitely some talk and stuff, and I basically told people that if he was in the movie, I didn't know how I was going to respond, because it just was like, it would just be almost too much.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I saw it, and yeah, man, I mean, it was, I was more emotional about that than I probably should have been. It was really, really hard for me to take in anything else.
Right.
After I saw that.
So it's so definitely stunning. In the positive for you. Like, it just like blew your mind. Like you.
Yeah. It did. And I mean,
Go into it with trepidation that it might just be like a travesty?
Yeah, forced or
not really, because I didn't really have time. It was like there was rumors, but there was no pictures, so right. I didn't really know what to expect. Then when they did it perfectly.
Oh, yes, I loved how they did it.
He's looking out over the Death Star, and you can see his shadow, like,
You see the reflection.
And then he turns, so it was like they did it perfectly to where you had time to, like, get ready.
Well,
but I still remember
it was very well blocked.
I was just like, "Whoa, man! What this dude looks like, Peter Cushing." Now, don't get me wrong. If you put them side by side, there's definitely some little differences here and there. But yeah. I can tell you right now that he looks enough like Peter Cushing to where I was shocked to the point where I could not pay attention to what was happening. I was like, the dialogue might as well have just not even been there, because I was like, whoa, man, he's not dead.
Yeah. But I think that was like 99% of the reaction of everyone, because like, I had no idea. I mean, I thought they were going to reference Tarkin. And so when Colleen R. is in there, and then that part comes up, and then I was like, I remember telling Colleen, I was like, oh my gosh, you can see him. You can see his reflection. But I thought, honestly, I thought that's all we were going to get. It was going to be the back of him and his reflection in the glass. And then they were going to move on. And when he turned, we both of us gasped. Like, it was an audible gasp, because we weren't expecting that. We were just thinking, okay, they're just going to show him from the back. He's going to deliver the line, and Krennic is going to walk off. But man, when he did that turn, good night. Yeah, it was exactly. A shocker.
Well, and it's even more. It's even if you take it in context with, because I had already read his book that's about him,
Tarkin.
Yeah, when you get all of that, and then you go into that, it's like, you know, whoa, okay.
Right.
And then when you see him in Clone Wars, and you see him in Rebels, you know, it's like there's more to it, because in Clone Wars, he actually goes on missions.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I loved how they incorporated him on the actual missions with the clones.
And right, the thing about it is, in the cartoon, in the animated aspect, it doesn't feel like, oh, you're just trying to resurrect the dead, because it's just the character, not the actor.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But Rogue One, I'm like with you, Eddie, I'm thinking, you know, this is just going to be a nice little clever nod. We're going to get some, you know, here's your little glimpse of Tarkin to kind of tie him into the whole greater story. Never imagining it was going to be such a major role.
Right, exactly.
Well, and the funny thing is that when they showed him in that one part, I was satisfied. I was like, okay, he got his little cameo. Krennic talked to him. We see that he's there. We're not going to see him again. And then when they bring him back two more times, and I'm not talking about two more times where you just look at him.
Yeah.
It was like entire 5 minutes.
Yeah. He's incorporated deeply into the story.
Yeah, like he's walking around talking. pointing at people and like making face gestures.
Right.
And you're like, whoa, man. I mean, these guys like really went to the trouble of, you know, they knew that he was a key part of the story because he is.
Exactly.
I mean, he's the guy.
And also to make it the, you know, the rendering to capture the little mannerisms and such. And that says a lot to both the intense study the actor had done and to the just reverent care that the animators took to make this respectful. And
right. Yeah, and I mean, and it's, I mean, I think that it's a testament to what kind of a impact he had on everybody and on that, on the franchise in general.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that this guy that was only in the movie for 5 minutes in Star Wars, you know, 30 or 40 years later, has more time in a movie after he's dead than he did in the original.
Exactly. That's what that, you're not lying, because he was much more deeply rooted in this story than the previous. We're well beyond the halfway point. We want to make sure we cover Christopher Lee and do him justice as well.
Yes.
But just real quickly, since you brought up the Tarkin book, have you read Lost Stars? By chance?
No.
You should.
No.
Tarkin plays a big role in that story as well. I'm only halfway through the book right now, but just at the halfway point, he's had two major entries into this story, so it's got quite a bit Tarkin in it. If you can manage to get a copy of it, you may be satisfied with what they're doing with him in that.
Oh, I'm sure I will be, but yeah, I highly suggest anybody that. Well, I mean, I would highly suggest anybody just look up Peter Cushing, and there's a website or there's a group called the Peter Cushing Appreciation. Oh, man, what is Peter Cushing Appreciation? It's like a group.
It's on Facebook.
It's on Facebook, and it's also on Twitter, and then they also have a Peter Cushing Appreciation website. But you can, and he's got books and stuff that you can get.
The Peter Cushing Appreciation Society UK.
Yes. Oh, nice. Yes. Yeah. And I've actually dealt with those guys a few times, just talking to them here and there. Cause, you know, I mean, he's a big influence on stuff, but the guy that runs that is pretty approachable and a pretty cool guy.
Yeah.
That's neat.
But
a big shout out to those folks. So be sure and reach out to them. Yeah, because Peter Cushing, I think defines sort of the feel of the imperial, the autocracy. You know, the iron fist of the empire. Yeah, you know, he's not going to just let it become this whole monkey show where, you know, Vader starts acting out, even though he's pretty much the pet of the emperor himself. Tarkin is willing to just, like, you know, smack Vader on the nose with a rolled-up newspaper.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, is that if you read deep into the canon, or really, honestly, not even really that deep, Vader was Tarkin's go-boy.
Yeah, and that was, I think, the idea was once the emperor is revealed... And then you discover how much Vader is really the emperor's creature. You literally, like, you know, his seeming master, like where Leia's talking about how, you know, I'm holding Vader's leash, as it were.
Right.
You get this impression as a film goer that Tarkin's like the man.
Well, and he was.
And then you find out that actually he's the man. There's like a bigger man behind him, ultimately.
But the thing is, though, is that before you got to the other guy behind him or above him, you had to get through Tarkin, and nobody ever got through Tarkin because he would always do what he did to Krennic.
Right, right. And that's why we didn't see the Emperor coming, because Tarkin was such like a force that you couldn't – an immovable force that you just assumed there was no one above him.
And before we move on to Dooku and Christopher Lee, I do want to point out that I'd mentioned earlier, you know, the the whole just dousing himself in lavender water so he would be smell refreshing on the set. Right. And there was a line from Carrie Fisher that tied in beautifully to that, where she's talking about, yes, you know, she had to deliver this dialogue of, you know, recognizing his foul stench. She's, the man smelled like flowers.
Yep. I'm kind of glad to know that, Peter Cushing, because him and I have that in common, because come summertime, Colleen and I, we like to just hang out in the backyard, but with summer comes mosquitoes, and we discovered a natural alternative to just spraying yourself with off is dabbing lavender oil on your exposed skin, and it keeps the mosquitoes away. So that's what we do every summer, is dab lavender oil on our arms and legs when we're out back. So it's kind of funny that Tarkin and I share that trait.
Well,
there was a lot of stagnant water on the Death Star.
Apparently. Right.
And they had a terrible mosquito.
Well, that's where
problem.
The Dianoga is. That's why they had a Dianoga problem, because of the stagnant water.
Well, what's funny is that we would buy soap.
Yeah.
I was always excited because my wife would get soap, and it would be from London, and it would be lavender.
There you go.
And I'd be like, that's right, man. I got real British soap. And
it's the same soap that Doctor Who uses.
That's right.
But no, just wrapping this up and then we'll go. When I went to London, I went to the Sherlock Holmes Museum.
Right.
They didn't have a single thing there of Peter Cushing.
Oh, wow.
And I let the guys there know that that was lame.
I just had this vision.
I know.
Bloody American.
Yeah.
So it was funny, though, because I was walking around, and for some weird reason, they had little vials of lavender.
Oh.
That said Sherlock Holmes Museum, and it had the Sherlock Holmes, like the silhouette of his, you know, his head silhouette with the hat.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's it. So I bought it, and I brought it all the way home, man. And it sits up on my thing in my music area.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay, now let's talk Christopher Lee.
All right, let's get into it. What do you know about Christopher Lee and his connection to Hammer? I mean, I know we've already touched on it some, but now that we're giving him our full attention.
Okay, a little bit, just some background on Lee. Lee was a spy. Lee, an actual spy in World War II.
Oh, Lee, okay.
It is amazing how many famous British people of that era were like spies who went on to become authors or actors or what have you.
Well, let me tell you a little something about him, though.
Yeah.
He wasn't just a spy. This dude was like a decorated spy. He was like legit, like licensed kill spy.
Wow. No, I did not know that. That's...
Yes. And on top of that, I believe if you look deep enough, you can probably even Google it while we're on the phone. He was the cousin, or by marriage, the nephew of Ian Fleming.
I knew that. I kind of half knew that. I'd heard that somewhere.
And that is how, I think, if I remember correctly, Fleming at one point suggested him to play Bond.
Hmm.
And then down the road, I mean, obviously he ended up.
Yeah.
It says here he was the uncle of Ian Fleming.
There you go. I knew there was a tie.
Well, now this one says nephew. Oh, see, this is why I hate the internet sometimes. Two different sites. One says uncle, one says nephew.
No, while we were talking, I changed the Wikipedia page.
Right. They were related in some way.
In some way.
Definitely. Yeah. He was
a spy. Marriage. It says by marriage here.
Yeah, that's why I was saying I couldn't remember if it was by marriage or what, but I knew it wasn't like, they weren't like directly related, but they were related by marriage.
So like Christopher Lee just got a hell of a lot cooler for everybody.
Right. I thought the singing Christopher Lee, that's what did it for me. Was it he doing music? He did a song with some rock band or punk rock or heavy metal band or something? What was
it? No, it was his band.
Oh, it was his band.
It was Yeah, every Christmas he would do a Christmas metal song.
Oh, Charlemagne? Wow. Is that what the name of the group was?
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, but no. That was the name of the album.
Oh, okay.
With Charlemagne.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There was two albums that were full albums that were about Charlemagne.
Okay.
And then every year for a few years, he would do like a single, like a Christmas single.
Yeah.
And you can find them on Spotify.
Yeah.
If you Google Christopher Lee, they're on there.
I was the xylophonist for Charlemagne Squeeze.
Well, the crazy thing is, though, is that when you listen to it,
yeah,
it's like you're listening to Saruman.
Oh, I totally, because I've heard it. I remember thinking the same thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's insane. It's like you're listening to Saruman or Count Dooku sing metal songs.
Right.
It's crazy. But
and so, yet again, I think you're speaking of like Count Dooku. It's almost like, again, into the prequel saga, it's like, who's our next Peter Cushing?
Right. Exactly.
Right.
And basically, who better, you know, all these years later?
Sure. And I'm telling you that once again, that was all Lucas.
Yeah.
That was all Lucas.
Of course. Yeah.
To go and find the classic.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And much like Cushing, you have that screen presence that you get so much implicit history in both characters because of those men's performances.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And what's funny is that half the time Lee wasn't even on the set. they just put him in there.
What?
Oh, yeah, dude. That Revenge of the Sith. In Revenge of the Sith, when they're in the throne room fighting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he wasn't even there.
What? You're kidding.
No, they CGI'd him in.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't even there.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I think at that point, he had gotten sick.
Oh, okay.
And he couldn't travel. And okay. Lucas was absolutely adamant that he was going to do it. So they, I guess, shot it like on green screen or whatever, and took his head and put it on another actor.
Wow.
Okay, so somebody else donned the suit and I mean,
of course. I mean, he does a backflip off of the...
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he used to do that at the in concerts every Christmas.
I mean, it's
you
know
that,
like
that backflip thing you do every year.
Titanium steel hips, apparently, and
that's
knees.
Right.
Good night. Well, yeah, yeah. That stuff would have been obviously CGI or a double, but yeah, I had no idea they did that. And that would have been for episode 3 only. In episode 2, he was.
Episode 2, I've not heard that was that way. Okay. The reason I knew about the episode 3 one is because I've got a book that they put out. It was Star Wars 365 Days.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, I have that.
That John Knoll did.
Mm-hmm.
And if you dig into that, they talk about how, or I think it was that book. I think it's that book. Yeah. Because that one broke down everything like, very
it gives you some pretty intense stuff. We referenced it in the past episode, but there's so much material there,
right? But yeah, the other thing with Lee is that he worked until the day he died. I mean, that dude worked and worked and worked and worked, and
so much so that there's a film coming out. It has not even come out yet that he is narrating.
Yep.
And a movie that just came out last year that he narrated. So, yeah.
That's a very British thing to do because, you know, even after he comes of his own, he starts making some serious bucks in his old age. It's like he still got that job to job. It's like, you know, you can, like, made more doing Lord of the Rings, just any given one of those movies, than you did in every single Hammer film combined.
Yeah.
There's so...
It's like, oh, but I must work.
Right.
Cushing's my favorite, but when it comes to weird, interesting, like, facts...
Yeah.
Lee definitely has a lot of those.
Oh, yeah.
He would read... I don't know how he had the time, but he would read Lord of the Rings once a year.
Yeah, he said as much in an interview where he was talking about, you know, some of the aspects of the overarching tale that just, you know, the thing was already epic. They had to, like, a lot of people were crying foul about Tom Bombadil not being in it. I'm like, you know, I've read it, and that just puts the brakes on the whole operation for
a good couple of chapters.
That was his absolute,
he was talking about how he was thrilled because he would read this annually.
Yeah, he read it annually, and the other thing, we were talking about how he wasn't on the set for Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
In The Hobbit, when they all meet, in Rivendell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he shows up in Rivendell, and they're like all sitting around that round table talking.
Yeah,
He wasn't there for that either.
Mm.
So they superimposed him into that too.
Okay, so you didn't just dial it in.
Well, you know, and in that film, or in the Lord of the Rings film, superimposition was the order of the day anyway.
True. Yeah, that's true.
More often than not, you're either shrinking or growing people.
But the thing is, though, is that in the original Lord of the Rings, I think he was most of the time actually on set.
Yeah.
The Hobbit.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I read that The Hobbit, when they all meet and they still think that he's good.
Yeah.
And he's not really there.
Yeah. Well, you got to figure there's a 10-year difference between the movies, if not 12.
Right.
So, I can definitely see that, where he was already starting to get to be that point, because that was like, you know, 2011, 2012, 13, 14, all that.
Let's as we're having to wrap up here pretty soon, just touch a little bit on the character of Dooku.
Yes.
Again, perfect casting for the nature of the character. I don't know, personally, I feel that... And maybe it's just because of a lot of the shortcomings that are part of the prequel saga. It just feels like Dooku is a character that had so much potential that was never tapped, and so much potential that was tapped.
Yes, for the movies.
Yeah.
Clone Wars, he was in, I would say, almost three-quarters of it.
Why I said the Clone Wars is like the apology letter to the prequels, because they delve in so deeply into each of these characters.
Yeah, it's like everything we didn't have time to talk about.
Right.
Yes. And it was basically exactly the way that Lucas wanted Star Wars to be in the first place, which is a serial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would start with the announcing, it would end. It would start with the announcing, it would end. It would start with the like Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
You know, and most, I mean, I guess they wouldn't really end like on a cliffhanger, but you always knew there was more coming.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
They would wrap up that particular story, but they would always hint at the next looming thing to come.
Right. Yeah. Right. But yeah, Dooku, and he definitely should. It would have been nice to see more of him.
Well, to get a better feel for the nature of the character, especially since you get some exposition that he was a former Jedi.
Yeah.
And you don't think about, in an organization like that, people are bound to just walk away from it.
Right.
And, you know, that was kind of one of the neat things that I really love about the character. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, Count Dooku used to be a Jedi. Mm-hmm. And it's like with an honorific like Count, you're thinking, oh, yeah, well, you know, why wouldn't he walk away?
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's probably got, like, you know, big family palace to get back to. And, yeah, I tried the Jedi thing for a while, but just got a little.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I can't understand the little green guy. And I just...
Well, I do know that the reason that the title, I mean, his name was Count Dooku was because of Count Dracula.
Oh, yes. I mean,
it was
with casting like that, you got to go that route. Right. He's some sort of, also the idea of him being of some sort of aristocracy.
Right.
And this sort of suggested history of, for whatever reason, you know, like maybe he got, in his youth, he was like, oh, you know, you're, the former Count and Countess Dooku were convinced by the Jedi Order to let, you know, their son come train.
True.
At some point, he's just like, you know, screw this. I got a yacht at home.
Right. But yeah, to kind of wrap the two of them up together, they definitely added a level of sophistication to what a lot of people back in the 70s was thinking was going to be just a revamp of Flash Gordon. Yeah.
Was meant to be.
Well, yeah, totally. It was completely meant to be.
I can't get the rights to Flash Gordon, so I'll make my own.
Exactly. And I mean, that's, I think, what Lucas was trying to do. Lucas was like, okay, I got all these nobodies that are playing the leads. Man, I got to have somebody with some weight.
That was the whole point behind Alec and S getting cast and, like you were saying, Peter Cushing, because, you know, it was to give that level of class to the project, which is,
well, to have those names on the marquee, or not necessarily on the marquee, but certainly on the poster, because you're like, you know, hey, look, the old wizard guy is played by the guy that blew up the bridge on the River Kwai,
is why they cast Marlon Brando as Jor-El, because they wanted Marlon Brando's name on the Superman poster, because no one really knew
who
Christopher Reeve was.
Exactly. Right.
You know, and you've got other people going, oh, whoa, man, Dr. Frankenstein and Van Helsing is playing a bad guy? Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
But yeah, I mean, that's, and then, you know, again, it's just showing just Lucas's respect.
Oh, yeah.
For those.
And brilliance to think of the little things that people, other filmmakers his age would not have thought of. Basically,
right.
I love the fact that, just to kind of bring it back, since we're bringing it back to the horror Hammer horror aspect, you've seen Sleepy Hollow, Eric, I'm assuming, the Johnny Depp Sleepy Hollow.
Did you
love Christopher Lee's part in that?
yeah, and I mean, but the thing is, though, is that if you watch that, I mean, if that movie would have been made in the 60s, it would have been a Hammer film.
And that's what I've always thought. Once I became more familiar with the aspect of the spirit of Hammer horror, because Colleen would watch Sleepy Hollow way back when we were still dating. She was like, you got to see Sleepy Hollow. I was like, eh, whatever. But I only watched it only because I was such a fan of Batman 89. I was like, well, I'll give it a try. It is Tim Burton, after all. But then once I got to understand what Hammer horror films were all about, and then years later, bought the DVD of Sleepy Hollow, watched it again. I thought, this is like a modern Hammer horror film.
And Michael Goh, who was Alfred in Batman, was also a stock actor for Hammer.
And, yes, I'm telling you that if you watch Sleepy Hollow again, you're going to see there may even be more.
I've always wondered that, because for a while. I kind of wondered if Ian McDiarmid had a tie to Hammer horror, but I don't think he ever did.
I can't remember offhand, but I can tell you that the other movie that felt like a Hammer film right away, and funny enough, it has a Star Wars tie, which just dawned on me because I was going to say something about it in the first place. The Wolfman with Benicio del Toro.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That is a Hammer film.
Oh, definitely. It definitely is.
Absolutely. And you know who directed that?
No.
The guy that created Boba Fett, Joe Johnston.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize he...
Yep.
I've seen that movie. I didn't realize that he did that, directed that.
Yeah. Yeah, he directed that film. And which just, once again, ties right back.
There you go, right back into the Star Wars.
Right. One more quick little nod for Christopher Lee. I got to say, I love watching documentaries in general, but I really love watching cryptozoology documentaries. But second to the cryptozoology documentaries are documentaries on the history of comic books and the comic book characters. One of my favorite comic book documentaries is narrated by Christopher Lee, and that's Necessary Evil, the supervillains of DC Comics.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that just like a phenomenal documentary? And to hear his voice,
yeah, right.
They couldn't. I mean, we have a documentary of the DC villains, and you get Christopher Lee to narrate it. It's like it's a perfect, perfect marriage. It's so good. I literally will put it on if I have trouble sleeping. I will literally put that on and fall asleep to it because his voice is like so soothing to fall asleep to. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would definitely recommend that if people haven't checked that one out. It's a great documentary.
And my final closing remark is I just can't help but wonder if the actor while standing in for Tarkin in Rogue One, if for authenticity, he was walking around in just his socks.
Oh, yeah. With lavender.
With lavender.
Would Cushing do that? Would he just walk around in socks?
No, apparently
the
boots,
yes.
You only see like maybe two shots, long shots of Tarkin.
Yeah.
Because those jack boots apparently were just a misery for him to wear.
I hated them. He hated them.
Yeah, and Cushing basically campaigned and said, you know, the only way I can do this is, you know, just shoot everything for higher up angles. I cannot wear these things.
Wow.
And he was like in sock feet.
Well, no, he was in slippers.
Oh, that's right. Slippers. Yes.
Yeah. And you can see pictures. There's pictures online.
Oh, yeah. You look up online. You can find pictures. Like, you know, here's Tarkin looking all officious and everything. And then he's got his little his house slippers.
He's got a little Winnie the Pooh slippers on, or something like that.
Right. He's got those bunny slippers from Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Right. Well, and the funny thing is that when I was going to go to Whitstable to where he lived, like for forever, his shoe guy, it's still there.
Really?
Like the guy that would make you shoes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, you could actually still go to that place, like the cobbler.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I got to ask, have you always been a fan of Peter Cushing, or is this something that came along later on? I mean, were you a fan of him before prior to him passing away?
Yeah. And the tie, I can tell you, the main tie was my grandfather.
Yeah.
I'm telling you that is what it is. My grandfather died when I was like six.
Yeah.
And for some weird reason, and it wasn't even consciously, it was like subconsciously,
yeah,
I would always somehow identify him mm-hmm. with my grandfather.
Yeah. Do you...
And it didn't really dawn on me until I was like older.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it was like, wait a minute, dude. This is what's happening here. I'm
uh-huh.
for some reason I'm drawing a parallel,
uh-huh.
but which may sound weird, but I mean I don't know. It just was a personal thing.
No, it doesn't sound weird at all.
But yeah, I was, and I mean, I grew up. Well, I would go to elementary school, and I wasn't allowed to watch horror movies when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I would go to the library and check out book after book after book after book of horror books, Frankenstein books,
uh-huh.
The making of Frankenstein, the making of you know, monster movie magic, blah, blah, blah. You know, I would check them out, read them, and basically live through that. And I can remember seeing the pictures. I mean, the Universal ones were the ones that really captured me at that time. But I remember seeing the pictures of Lee and of Cushing and going, whoa, that's way different than Universal.
Yeah, exactly.
They always attracted me more because I was attracted to the idea that these movies in the 50s and 60s were rated X.
Uh-huh.
And it was so tame compared to what we did.
Right, right. Well, I mean,
just that they had the balls to do that. Then.
Right.
They were like, you know, we're going to push the envelope. You know, we're going to have Cushing step on a heart, or we're going to have him drop eyeballs on the ground, and you're going to hear the squish while they're walking around.
Well, it's to that same aspect. Growing up, that was the thing surrounding the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, was that it was rated X. And so when I finally got around to actually seeing it, I thought, that's not that bad. I mean, because it was, but for the time, right, it was just crazy. I was asking about Peter Cushing. I was going to ask you if you remember where you were when you heard that he had passed away, because I do, oddly enough.
Not really him.
Because I was working at MJ Designs at the time in Duncanville, and I remember it's so vivid in my mind. Why? I'm not sure. I guess because I was a fan of him because he was Tarkin. But I remember I was stocking the shelves. And I remember what side of the store was on. I remember which aisle I was on when a friend of mine who was also a Star Wars fan, is like, hey, man, I just heard on my way up here that Peter Cushing died. I was like, really? And that stuck with me. Like, the fact that I remember exactly where I was when I heard the news that he had passed away. You know, I thought, wow, that's something else. But
I had the exact experience with Lee, because I remember I was in bed, mm-hmm. and my wife woke me up to tell me that Lee had died,
mm-hmm.
and I just was like, oh no,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I mean, that's so crazy because he's like 90 years old. But at the same time, I just like was sitting there. I was just laying there, going, "Oh man, really?"
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I have to kind of tell on myself with Peter Cushing. I think I may have mentioned this on the show in the past somewhere about how I somewhere in the 80s when I was trying to compose my own little. You know, half-assed version of Starlog as an aspiring sci-fi journalist, and was writing an article on Star Wars and referred to Cushing as the late Peter Cushing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is my friend Steve, this is a long-running in-joke, the late Peter Cushing, because he would still be about 12 to 15 years out from actually being dead. So I always, you know, in my defense, I always say, yeah, but I predicted
it. I think we talked about that like either on the first or second episode of this podcast. It was very early on when you brought that up. I was like, what is wrong with you? I don't know if I want to do this podcast with you anymore.
Right. Yeah, this is my older brother had said something about Peter Cushing having died, and that was like, that was the level of journalistic integrity I had back then.
Didn't bother to fact check. No fact checking or anything.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I would have to go to the library or something and do some serious research. So I just went with it.
I think the reason why I remember so vividly Peter Cushing, like where I was at the time and who told me and exactly which aisle of the store I was stocking when I was told, is because up until then, none of the Star Wars actors had died. You know, and
That's true, especially not the big name.
That's what I mean, like the big name actors. You know, Alec Guinness, I always forget, passed away in 2000, yeah. I always forget that he died after Phantom Menace came out. You know, I always remember that he had passed away prior to the prequels, but in fact he didn't. And I don't know why I can't get that part straight in my head.
Yeah, he lived up to the point where without a beard and mustache, he was looking like Elmer Fudd.
Well, he was, actually. That's weird.
Yeah, now you'll never think of it the same way again.
Right.
But we need to go ahead and close
that. Why he would always walk around in his old age saying, "That wascally porg."
Right. Oh,
that,
oh, yeah, right.
That explains
right.
Everything. And then we finally got to see what he was talking about.
And just real quickly, just looking over at Christopher Lee's IMDb, I can't believe I didn't know this until now, that he was in the second made-for-TV Captain America movie.
Oh, yeah.
I did not remember.
He's the villain.
Yeah. And I was like, I
just watched it a couple of days.
Really? I used to watch those, being a lifelong Marvel fan, I would always watch those whenever they would come on TV, or, you know, the Hulk, of course, was one of my favorite shows growing up, and the Spider-Man made-for-TV movies. Never remember Christopher Lee being in the second one, but in my defense, they always seemed to only show the first one. The second one would only come on every so often. It didn't come on as often as the first. But yeah, that's bizarre.
Yeah, it's Captain America Death.
Death Too Soon.
Yeah, I actually, because we... when Infinity War came out at work, I work at a movie store. We started playing the offbeat Marvel movies.
Nice.
And somebody put in those, but I actually own it. It's the red brown Captain America's. And
don't get Andrew from Hey Kids Comics started. He loves him from red brown.
We've
got to close this guy out.
Okay, all right.
But I do want to, in closing, Eric, as a longtime Hammer Horror fan, were you already steeped in Hammer Horror before you saw Star Wars? And did seeing Peter Cushing in that role seem like, wow, you know, here's one of my guys?
I was way too young.
Okay,
way too young, man. I was like 5.
Okay, I forget that, like, not everybody's old people like me. So.
Yeah, no, I was 5 when I saw Star Wars.
So as you're getting into Hammer, the transverse would be, as you're getting into Hammer horror films, you're like, hey, it's Target.
And that's what I did. That's what I would do.
Yeah, see, exactly. Like, hey, look, everybody, it's Tarkin. It's like, well, this kind of one predates the other. Eric, thank you for joining us, because you brought a lot of insight. The purpose of this episode wasn't so much the characters, as I said at the opening, it was about those two actors, and what a wonderful way to kind of have a birthday tribute to two major contributors to the Star Wars universe.
Yep. Absolutely. And I would definitely tell everyone to check out their movies, each of them. I mean, some of them, they played movies on their own. Wicker Man.
That's right.
You know, Rasputin the Mad Monk. Those are some good Christopher Lee ones.
Return from Witch Mountain. That was a big one. That was one of the first movies as a kid that I remember seeing Christopher Lee in was The Witch Mountain.
Well, don't forget, and what's better than that is you've got Christopher Lee and Betty Davis.
Right. You can't.
You know, there you go.
You got no complaints there. Nope. Eddie, thank you. This has been great. A great idea, by the way, for tying in with the two birthdays as we hit in that corridor as it worked out. And it's been great to get the show back up and running. We were both missing doing the audio show as well as the live stream show. And speaking of which, with this hitting the way it does, you can see Eddie and myself and the gang from DallasOnAir.com, home of the Rancor Pit Live, Figments, and Isle of Toys, at the upcoming DFW G.I. Joe and Action Figure Show in Grapevine, Texas. I believe that is June 9th and 10th. And in Grapevine, Texas, the Grapevine Convention Center, these guys put on a really great show. They bring in some amazing vendors. If you love the classic or the modern G.I. Joes, this is the show for you. If that's not your thing, there's a lot of other amazing toys to be had. If you're looking for some bargains or some hard to find toys, every time I go out there, I'm like, oh, they're, you know, I'm not going to like come home with more stuff because I just keep, somebody has what I'm looking for, or stuff I didn't know I was looking
for. I tell people every year because, like, well, I'm not really into G.I. Joe. I say they have everything. Star Wars. I mean, they'll have like old vintage Migos of the Bionic Man, Captain America, Amigo. I mean, they'll everything. He-Man.
That's stuff you've
Turtles,
never seen.
I mean, they have everything.
And, hey, is that the G.I. Joe show where they're going to have special guest Marlon Wayans and Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
But he's now going by the name of Larry Hama.
Yes, indeed. Lest we forget, Larry Hama, one of the icons of G.I. Joe.
Hero. I mean, the man who made me want to become a comic book creator. Like, no joke. It's Larry Hama is the reason why, as a kid, I said, I want to grow up and make comic books for a living.
That is so cool.
So, wait. Marlon Wayans isn't going to be there.
No. I'll just play. Nor is Peter Cushing.
But you can come out and see not only the Rancor Pit, Olive Toys, the Figments, but you'll be able to meet the guys from Vagabond Nerds and more than likely the crew from Just a Sec. So
Next issue as well.
That's right.
Potentially. We haven't got 100% on that. But come out and meet Jedi Jansen of DallasOnAir.com, who is made all this happen. And we're going to do some live streaming from the show for the first time ever. We're going to be doing the Rancor Pit from a remote location. So that's going to be pretty cool. If you're keen to get more information, go to Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info and check out the June listings and link on over. Just click on DFW G.I. Joe. It'll take you straight to the website to get some more poop on where to find us.
Eric, plug away on your podcast, your website, anything else that you do.
Well, I do a Star Wars humor and news website with, strangely enough, Mr. Medina's older sibling, Victor.
Yeah.
It's revengeofthefifth.net, and that's – actually, you can get to it either way. Revenge of the Fifth spelled out, or Revenge of the Fifth with a 5-T-H. Yeah. We do that. I also run a movie site, moviegeekfeed.com. I started using that again, by the way.
That's when we first met you, I think you were doing Movie Geek Feed.
Yeah. Yeah, so it had been up there and archiving stuff, but I decided to switch back to it because, I mean, I'd been doing it for 10 years plus, I get my free movies that way. So.
There you go.
Actually, I'm not playing.
Oh, I know you're not.
But, yeah, I'm doing that. And that's about
besides
being a parent of a year and a half old girl. Oh, dude, the podcast thing is through moviegeekfeed.com. You can see it. I just have it through SoundCloud. I mean, honestly, I've only done a few of them.
What's it called?
It
has something to do with a phone.
That's such
a clever name. I love it because you literally are just phoning it in.
Right. And that really is. What I do is I call somebody and just talk to him for 15 or 20 minutes about whatever I want to talk to him about. Jason Quayne and me talked about Lost in Space, the show. Me and Blakey talked about – what the crap did me and Blakey talk about?
Oh, there's no telling with Blakey. Probably people hands.
What the crap were we talking about? But I did one with Bobby, too. I can't remember
reason to go to moviegeekfeed.com and find out.
Absolutely, yeah. Find out for yourself and look for Eddie and I on the first and third Sundays of every month with the Rancor Pit live on DallasOnAir.com. And that is 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. on those first and third Sundays of each month. And we're gearing up here. It's not going to be long before we have to tackle the 4th of July, 2018. I'm going to find my tricorn hat.
That's going to be a big month for Rancor Pit. Is going to be the 4th of July. For Figments, it's going to be our JFK month. So
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
So, and also, yeah, check out Figments on the first Sunday of every month from 9:30 to 10:30. Or on the third Sunday of every month, you can catch my show, Isle of Toys, A-I-S-L-E, like the shopping, like a store aisle. And, I'm spent. Well, thank you for joining us here on the Ranker Pit here at the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com.
This awesome music is provided by Ray Reezy. That's R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. You can find him on Instagram and SoundCloud. On Instagram, it's at R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. And on SoundCloud, it's soundcloud.com/R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. You can also contact him at rayreezymusic@gmail.com. Make sure you check out this guy's stuff. It's really awesome. Thanks for listening, and may the Force be with you.